Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today's the day when we recap the politics news of 2020. And what to say? Amid all the unthinkable things that happened this year, do the normal rules still apply? Are there new rules for what happens when our state's most fundamental institutions are under attack from a lethal pandemic? Or have the conditions of this year exposed how breakable the old rules of politics can be? By the way, if anybody knows the remedy for 12 uninterrupted months of nonstop earth-shattering news, we're here for that too. And we're hoping that Adrian Hemond and John Selleck can help us sort through this. Adrian is the founder and CEO of Grassroots Midwest, a bipartisan advocacy firm based in Lansing, and John Selleck is founder and CEO of Harbor Strategic, a public affairs and PR firm in Lansing and Southeast Michigan. John, Adrian, I am delighted to find you both still capable of speech.
Right back at you.
let's start by going around the table with what we think were the biggest, most surprising stories out of Lansing this year. And you need not limit yourself to just one if you have to. John, would you like to start us out?
Well, I mean, I could have a really long list. It's obviously start with COVID. You could go back to talking about the governor's road plan, the death threats, the VP nomination. You can go down the list. It's a really huge one. And what I try to get myself to do is look at the big picture, because every minute by minute, there's something new and crazy going on. I try to step back and look at the year as a whole and say that the surprise would mostly have to be inside the Lansing bubble. That normally the traditional dates and deadlines of what a governor proposes and does and instigates would be how we judge the year. And in Governor Whitmer's first year, those things were kind of up and down. There was a highlight on auto insurance. There was the end of the year brawl and battle about the budget. And going into this year, which now seems 100 years ago, she was going to kind of go it alone. And she started with her state of the state saying she was going to fix the damn roads.
We can get to work on these state trunk line roads and freeways and take advantage of today's low interest rates. Over the long haul, we're gonna actually save money. It just makes sense. So from now on, when you see orange barrels on a state road, slow down and know that it's this administration fixing the damn roads.
And lo and behold, something jumped in and interrupted all of our lives. It was COVID. So now we look at this year and the whole year was changed the whole direction of her political life and her governorship. On the policy side, we don't really know what else she might have accomplished had she not had a deal with COVID. And politically, we know that she became nationwide. I mean, she went from a former state senator to being nationally famous and a vice presidential
CBS
nominee.
CBS has learned that there has been at least one face-to-face meeting presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden has had as he prepares to name his running mate. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer traveled by...
Democratic sources telling NBC News Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer met with Biden for several hours last weekend.
How's the vetting process going so far? Are you being vetted by Mr. Biden?
You know what? I've had a conversation with some folks, but the fact of the matter is all of my energy is going into helping my state through this crisis, unlike one that we've
seen. In some ways, the parallel I draw, which my Democrat friends like Adrian will dislike, are that, you know, this is kind of like George W. Bush's first term. His first year, he was busy trying to fix reading scores in America, and he got whispered to in his ear in a classroom that the 9/11 had taken place and New York had been attacked. And his presidency was never the same. And the same similar kind of thing happened to Governor Whitmer with COVID. Now we need to figure out if the rest of her term will be defined by COVID, or if she's able to move on to some other policy initiatives in addition to fixing the COVID issue.
Right. Adrian, what are the standouts for you this year?
You know, I think Governor Whitmer has had a really tough year, but I think overall pretty good year. She seems to have, most of the public seems to remain with her, even if they're a little fatigued. I think the biggest surprise of the year is what an abject failure as an institution the legislature has been. If you look at, John alluded to how the governor started the year off, sort of proposing to go it alone with the roads. There's obviously been gridlock in Michigan politics, between the governor and the legislature since she took office. There have been issues in the legislature for a number of years with, you know, the legislature sort of not playing its constitutional role. And the legislature has essentially disappeared through multiple disasters this year, whether it's COVID or, you know, the flooding events in Midland. You know, the governor has, you know, whether you support her or not, has really stepped into the breach with some leadership. And the legislature's been gone a lot. There's been a lot of, you know, trading of barbs back and forth between the legislature and the governor. But the legislature's been out of session a lot this year. They were focused on, particularly in the House, they were focused on elections.
The testimony focused on the ballots and the computer systems used here at the TCF Center.
Everything that happened at that TCF Center was fraud. Every single thing.
We're elected officials, but we don't wear robes and we don't make decisions on what is going on here.
Several testified they have talked with the Trump legal team. A House Oversight Committee will take testimony tomorrow, and it is to include Trump top attorney Rudy Giuliani.
And they allege massive cheating, particularly on the part of the Democrat Party of Detroit.
There hasn't been a whole lot that's gotten done in the legislature this year when, you know, perhaps the citizens in Michigan need it the most.
You two have both been to the rodeo a few times. You were around to see Michigan's response to 9/11 and the Great Recession, Detroit's bankruptcy, the Flint water crisis. And yet here we are talking about this as one of the most astonishing years ever. So much of Michigan's brand is resilience. Are there things about 2020's political news that have shaken your faith in that? Adrian, could you start out?
Sure, absolutely. I think the, you know, the ongoing drama with the presidential election, we're now in mid-December, mind you, you know, is astonishing. And the idea that so many folks on the Republican side of the aisle have sort of thrown in their lot with the idea that we have to invalidate the results of a Democratic election. That's shocking. And, you know, there's been a fair amount of sort of rot in American democracy for a while, but it's, you know, seeing that sort of burst into the open this year where there is, you know, a sizable faction of the Republican Party that just wants to invalidate the election, that's not great for the long-term health of the country.
John, what about you? Do you think there's anything in 2020 that Michigan cannot get past?
No, I don't think that. So I guess I've got one thing to hold on to. Thank you for giving me that. You know, I think one thing even for me, who I've been in politics around the Capitol since I got out of college, which was quite a long time ago now, is even for me to open my eyes and see the level of frustration and distrust with government and with politicians. You know, a lot of people are in a real big hurry because they can't stand him to blame Donald Trump for all the negativity and the seeming, you know, easy ability to attack what were fundamental institutions of America and a democracy. And I think that gives him too much credit. I think what he should get credit for, and if there's a sense of credit, is that he spotted it and he went after it because he already saw it, that it's there. And he may have amplified it and fired it up, but it was already there. And that is going to be the biggest challenge going forward, is I think especially even for Democrats, as hard as they may not like hearing this, if they really want to try to unify the country and move forward, they're going to have to not just dance on Donald Trump's grave and look down at a big part of the Republican Party who is not trusting a lot of things. They're going to have to figure out how to find the layers, you know, in the middle, in center right, that can still be sort of like brought back into believing that things can get done and that two sides can work together. It would be really tempting to just party and celebrate and go off and worry about how they handle, you know, the left and the progressives in their own party. But I think they should see even from this election that despite the fact that Joe Biden won, a whole lot of people still switched their ticket and went back, voted for Republicans and for conservatives. And they need to not just brush them aside.
Today, we're wrapping up the politics news of 2020 all across Michigan with John Selleck of Harbor Strategic and Adrian Heeman of Grassroots Midwest. You know, John, when you say that Donald Trump exposed rifts within America, I kind of hear you saying that he also exposed those same rifts within the Michigan electorate. I mean, this is a divided state. And although Joe Biden did win in Michigan by 150,000 votes, Trump got more votes than ever and new votes this year. Adrian, do you think that you learned anything essential about the political divides in Michigan this year from everything that happened?
Well, I think there are a couple of things that are very interesting that we learned. Number one is that, negativity and negative partisanship motivate people, right? Donald Trump is a very negative candidate in a traditional political sense. And the political campaign this year, all up and down the ballot, focused on the person of Donald Trump, right? You were either for him or you were against him. And that determined a lot of the motivation of people to show up and vote. And I think it's the thing that remains to be seen is whether that's durable, whether someone other than Donald Trump can replicate that coalition. So I think we learned that the Republicans have an opportunity to try to forge a different coalition going forward, for the long term. But I don't know if there's a figure in the Republican Party that can turn people out the way that Donald Trump turned Republican voters out this year.
My guests today are Adrian Hemond of Grassroots Midwest and John Selleck of Harbor Strategic. We're talking about Michigan politics news in 2020. In just a moment, we're going to read the tea leaves of the presidential race a little bit more deeply. That's after a short break. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We're digesting all the politics news of the year with John Selleck of Harbor Strategic and Adrian Hemond of Grassroots Midwest. Guys, any presidential election year is a big one, but this year, wow, record turnout, plus a mammoth pandemic-driven mail-in vote for Michigan, plus our state right on the edge of a national struggle by the Trump campaign to redefine legal votes and possibly turn the course of the election. Donald Trump did activate thousands of new voters in Michigan in this year, this election. One could argue on the strength of the past 4 years. Do you think that there are any candidates afoot in the Republican Party, either local candidates or national presidential, figures with presidential aspirations, who could get those voters back in play in elections of the future?
Well, it's a challenge every cycle to replicate a presidential level turnout compared to what we call the off year or midterm turnout. And we might be entering a zone where all those kind of old rules continue to be sort of dumped out on the ground and everything is very different. Number one, you're making an assumption when we talk about that Donald Trump isn't still front and center in the Republican Party in the midterm. And I think that it would be risky to think that he's not going to be front and center in the Republican Party going forward. He's positioning himself indeed to still control the party and be the main voice of what happens. That said, we're already seeing up and down the party, people trying to step up and jump into place in case there is that void for them to do so. Mm-hmm. We've seen it in the Senate, specifically with Senator Josh Hawley in Missouri and a few others who are trying to jump in there, but we see it all the way down to what now is happening under the radar as far as the public's concerned with the fight for who will be the next chair of the Michigan Republican Party. The current chairman, Chair Laura Cox, seemingly is running again and certainly worked really hard to reelect Donald Trump. A former GOP chair, Ron Weiser, and has entered into the race and is pushing back. And they're all seeking to be the heir to the Trump legacy and to say who was the most, who worked the hardest for Donald Trump. And to the extent that he and his image and his push is still involved in the party, we may still see a lot of those voters turn out, because what's happened overall in a very rapid sense, all the way down to the state house level, is that national realignment. And before, we would always talk about it, and we still probably will to some extent, in terms of identity politics, where what are Black voters doing, what are white voters doing, what are Hispanics doing, LGBT. But now I think what we're starting to see in a lot of these numbers that the real divide is education and economics. And that allowed Donald Trump to really pick up a lot of votes. Even I just saw yesterday in the Bronx, which has a really, in New York City, which has a really high population of Hispanics, he greatly increased his vote totals there, and people are scratching his head. But that's where we're getting hints of what this, the next sort of divide that we're faced, or the divide that we're facing now, but we're just sort of getting our hands around.
John, a couple of weeks ago, you showed me some figures outlining trends in counties and towns that went for Donald Trump in 2016 and for Joe Biden this time. Could we recap those for folks who may not have been paying as much attention to demographic details?
Sure. Well, one of the easiest areas of the state to talk about was the northern Lower Peninsula. Donald Trump ran up massive historical margins of over 70% in a huge amount of counties. If you just started sort of at the Clare Rest area, where the big lighthouse is, and worked your way north up to the Mackinac Bridge, that whole area was just sort of deemed Trump country. And in retrospect, we even looked back and said, gosh, he made these visits that most Republicans were scratching their head about. He showed up in Saginaw, and he showed up in Cadillac, and usually GOP nominee candidates don't show up in those areas. And he already saw in his data that all these non-college white rural or blue collar workers were moving into his camp. And I think everybody thought that he was just going to repeat that kind of gangbusters vote result in northern Michigan. But as we're starting to look at the numbers more closely and see what happened between 16 and 20, we really saw in that northern Michigan area a split between those who went to college and graduated and those who did not. And the quick way to do it is the counties that are along the Lake Michigan shore, where all our more popular tourism areas are, like Petoskey and Charlevoix, all the way down to Ottawa County. We've seen a lot of people with college degrees who picked up and moved there either for retirement or for their new wireless careers. And in those areas, Trump lost big margins, including in Leelanau County, where the college education level is actually over 40%. Where if you go to a few counties to the east into the middle of the peninsula, all the way over to Lake Huron, they're as low as 12%. So there was already a divide showing up in that, what everybody thought was the tip of the mitt being super Republican. But because of that college divide, the more wealthy counties along the Lake Michigan shore started moving toward the Democrats.
So, Adrian, I wonder, in the same breath that we ask, is there a Republican who can hold on to the newer Trump voters? Maybe should we also be asking whether there are Democratic policies or candidates who can hold on to some of the moderates who went for Joe Biden this time? Or is that even the right question to be asking for the Democratic Party right now?
No, I don't know that it is. I mean, the Biden candidacy is in a very real sense a sort of placeholder. And no disrespect to the president-elect, but Joe Biden is sort of the very picture of a replacement-level Democrat. He's more or less in the center of the party, maybe a little bit to the right of the center of the party, been around for decades. I think that the smart thing for the Democratic Party is to really actually engage with, while they hold the presidency, some conversations about the future, right? What does the future of the party look like? What is their message to voters, particularly while this realignment is sort of taking shape? There's an opportunity to sort of control a certain amount of how that's going to happen. These realignments don't happen overnight. A great example of that is the last sort of major realignment of the South away from Democrats that actually took decades to play out. In the late 80s and early 90s, there were still Democratic congressmen like Ralph Hall who were getting elected, again, as Democrats by Republican presidential voters. Ralph Hall eventually switched to become a Republican in the 90s, but that's how long that process took to play out from the late 60s. So these realignments don't happen overnight. I think the smart thing for Democrats is to be thinking about their future, right? How are they going to talk to this changing electorate? It's changing demographically, but also the alignment of voters is changing around different sort of issues and especially different cultural markers. John pointed out the education piece of that. I think that's a very, very important piece of it, but some of its density as well. It's pretty clear that the more closely together people live, the more likely they are to vote for Democrats. You know, the further away that people live, the less connected they are, the more likely they are to vote for Republicans. Well, that has implications for how you do politics. Mm-hmm. And I think Democrats would be smart to be thinking about that.
There's nothing new about the idea that each party gets its energy from its extremes. You could use a different word that's nicer than that. But with the Democrats, it's from the progressives, and from the Republicans, it's Trumpism and what's happening over on the right wing. And at times, the establishment of each party, for the most part, has been able to hold those folks down. And when I'm asked about Trump, this is how I like to describe and talk about this. But every once in a while, that energy has burst through and taken over and overcome the establishment. The old example I have in my personal political experience in Michigan is Jeffrey Figer. I worked for John Engler. We won that election, but Jeffrey Figer was the outsider. He was the energy of the wild child part of their party, and it overcame the establishment and ran it over, and they got crushed in the general election to Engler for that term. In 2010, the energy of the Republican Party was with the Tea Party. They overcame the establishment, so to speak, and they elected Rick Snyder. He just didn't turn out to be what they saw.
What they thought, yeah.
That was a lot different. Yeah, and I'd even make an argument that Dana Nessel was the case for the Democrats in 2018. She was the one that like overtook the establishment, knocked back the unions, beat the sort of like preferred former prosecutor from West Michigan candidate to take her job, and she's carried out that line of thought in her whole way that she carries herself as AG. So I think the Democrats have played their last get out of jail free card at the presidential level. There are no more Joe Bidens. That's over with. So what will be fascinating to me when you talk about the future of the Democratic Party is, had any of the other candidates won, we could be easily sitting here talking about President Trump. They played that get out of jail free card. And so what is it that they do next?
Right. Today, we're wrapping up the politics news of 2020 all across Michigan with John Selleck of Harbor Strategic and Adrian Heeman of Grassroots Midwest. I'm glad that Adrian brought up pandemic politics, because although I know no one is exactly excited about rehashing the election, it seemed like some very unusual things happened that might shed light on what really motivates voters these days. We had the situation where most candidates couldn't campaign door to door and in in-person events like they usually do. And we had a situation where voters were, in many cases, voting in the privacy of their homes. There absolutely were people who went to the polls, but this mammoth absentee vote that brought in literally millions of people to a vote by mail system. What's changed in how people might think about campaigning and just finding voters? I mean, I shudder to think that this might mean even more dominance in social media advertising. But is that where 2020 leaves us, John?
You can count on that if Facebook is allowed back up off the mat. You know, they're still in the mode where they're not allowing themselves to accept political advertising. And then you saw the lawsuits this week by a majority of the states coming after them for being a monopoly. So there's some question there right now how that will all turn out. But what I've said all along about no reason absentee, and if we get into early voting and people switching, is that there's just going to be way more money pumped into politics. That's usually considered a bad thing. It seems strange that with the increase in participation in democracy improving, then all these dollars are going to flow in, and they did. They flow in like on the record, and they flow in as dark dollars too, because these voters need to be grabbed as soon as you can get your hands on them. I think the Republicans were able to, they started to turn the ship a little bit with their own voters voting by absentee or voting by mail after the president initially tried to squash it. And those differences certainly still showed up really clearly in who voted on election day and who voted absentee. But I think that horse is out of the barn, and we're going to continue to see more emphasis on essentially harvesting voters from their homes long before we get to election day. And that means a lot more social media ads, like you said, a lot more phone calls, a lot more mail, a lot more people knocking on your door. And then all that takes a lot of money.
Adrian, what are you advising people if they're thinking about campaigns of the future based on what we saw this year?
Well, I think number one, you've got to be prepared to take account for what's going to happen next year, right? Which is that we're going to reapportion the entire legislature. Most of the county commission seats are going to get reapportioned. And you add to that the sort of historic turnout levels that we saw in different parts of the state. And I think that there's a lot of uncertainty as to what does it actually look like to run for office in some of these places, whether you're running for county commission or you're running for the state legislature or you're running for Congress. You don't know what the district lines are going to look like, and you don't actually have a great idea of what turnout's going to be.
Yeah. I spent a couple of nervous weeks after the election worrying about Americans' trust in their election system. I'm still kind of worried about it, but I'm also wondering if maybe some of what people say right now about not trusting the election, specifically supporters of Donald Trump, might be situational. If I want to know if either of you are really concerned about whether the vote is going to be affected in future years by what's happened this year and some of the messaging coming out of the Trump campaign about stolen elections, or whether people tend to see their own hometown political processes as a little bit different. Adrian, do you want to go first?
Sure. I mean, I do think there's a situational element to this, but that doesn't make it really any better. I think the problem here is that if you have a group of folks, a group in the electorate that has just decided that any election that they don't win is somehow illegitimate, and there's an ecosystem of information out there, or, you know, whether it's true information or not, that sort of feeds into that, right? So I think it's poisonous to democracy either way, but I think we're likely to see it continue. I think that that's unfortunately kind of here to stay. It's hard to stuff that back in the pot.
John, what do you think?
Well, I need to always like compliment the host more often, so I'll start off with that. I think that what you just what you just said is pretty interesting, and it applies in other areas of politics that you feel all right about your local area. There's like, if you poll people about how they think schools and education are going, they think it's going terrible. But if you ask how their local school's going, they're feeling pretty good about it.
Drain the swamp, but my congressman is okay. Yeah.
Yeah, right. If you live in Howell, you probably think that the elections in Livingston County are well done. If you live in Wayne County or in Detroit, you probably think your elections are doing fine. It's when we have a statewide election, not just a local or a congressional election, where we say, aha, those people over there must be screwing around, or they could be, or I suspect it. And this distrust, it requires a giant psychological study, that's for sure. That's beyond us. But that distrust has always been there. And that was, you know, one thing I mentioned early on is the kind of thing that I opened my own eyes to, is just the incredible distrust in almost everything. And the idea that people kind of get into conspiracy theories. I mean, how could we be surprised about this? We've been watching movies and TV specials about the JFK assassination forever. You can make a whole list of conspiracy theories about Al Capone having tunnels and all these other things. And so why wouldn't elections and other things fall into that zone? And then you add all the stress and the mental anguish and the sadness of COVID and being locked in your houses and spending all your time twiddling your fingers looking at social media. The ground is pretty fertile for that. Nonetheless, there's little doubt on the one hand that what the president is doing is terrible. And his goal is to not admit a loss, to keep control of his own party, to position himself for the future. And maybe just in case he can push one of his judges or one of his legislatures into moving, he could even keep the presidency. And I really don't see that happening, but he sure has riled up a whole lot of people. And like I said earlier, that distrust and uncertainty was already sort of there, and he helped grow it and make it bigger. So I think it's here to stay. And that is why one of the most important things that can happen is that Secretary of State Benson and all the other county clerks, a lot of whom I've seen on social media, being very transparent. And it's exactly what they need to do. They do need to carry out their audits. They do need to do everything on live on Facebook feeds and talking about what they're doing to audit and reveal the results of the audits, because you can't look at all the cranky people as a monolith. There's going to be a certain layer of people, no matter what you do, that have a sense that it's all crooked and wrong. And we're not going to change their mind. But there's a lot of other people that are just hearing these sort of tidbits that fit into the sort of that gossipy sitting around. Did you hear about this? Did you hear about that? That doesn't sound so good to me. They need to be reassured to some extent to keep them in the loop, or to keep them close to the fact that elections actually still are valid. They need to see that their officials went full out and showed that audits and transparency ruled the day. And if there were some problems, that they'll get fixed. The desire by some who are so annoyed with Rudy Giuliani, so annoyed with that person that testified and ended up on Saturday Night Live, they want to basically say to all these people who have concerns or doubts, you're an idiot. And when the further we go down that road and keep shoving those people down, the more likely they are to depart from the system. And that's when we really run into serious problems.
We're wrapping up the year's political stories with Adrian Hemond of Grassroots Midwest and John Selleck of Harbor Strategic. Let us put a bow on this and get it out of here. When we come back, we're going to talk about the pandemic, pandemic politics, and more. Don't go away. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer, and we are glad to welcome John Selleck of Harbor Strategic and Adrian Hemond of Grassroots Midwest for a year-end wrap-up of politics news, warts and all. John, Adrian, as we think back to last February when the alarms started to sound about this new illness called COVID, there was a Midwestern governor named Gretchen Whitmer who was trying to coax Republicans into some agreement to help her fix the roads. How would you have described the state of Gretchen Whitmer's political stature and her political capital at that point? Adrian, before all this happened, what kind of place was Gretchen Whitmer in?
Well, I think, she was in a place where she had more or less told the legislature, look, if you're not going to help me with fixing the roads, I'm going to do what I'm allowed to do under the law in terms of borrowing and using the state's borrowing authority to fix what roads we can. So in terms of political capital, I don't know if she was in a bad place in terms of where the public was concerned, but certainly in terms of her political capital with the legislature, it wasn't great, which is why she had made this plan to sort of try to do on her own what she could within the bounds of the law.
Yeah. John, if 2020 had ended last February, what would you have said about Gretchen Whitmer's situation?
I think she had done kind of she'd achieved kind of a middling status. She hadn't really blown anything up or done anything terribly bad, but she had not been able to make a whole lot of progress. And, I worked in the legislature when she was a state representative there, and she's always been very aggressive in a state senator, always the front person for the party, always the ones attacking, coming after the Republicans. And I think she had she reined that in a little bit, but, there's all different kinds of leaders, and her thing, I think she and her team even referenced John Engler as an example, not from a policy perspective, but as more of like a field general perspective that she was going to charge forward.
Yeah.
And that's how she's done COVID. And that's how she was attempting to start this year when she did a road plan.
John, how did you see Gretchen Whitmer evolving in 2020?
She definitely evolved in the sense that she became a national figure. And if we go back to 2018, I was involved in the governor's race in 2018 on the Republican side. Gretchen Whitmer's own party didn't think that she was necessarily the candidate. Mike Duggan, the mayor of Detroit, Gary Peters was brought into a meeting with the UAW saying, hey, you should look at running for governor because we don't think Gretchen Whitmer is the person. She has come an incredibly far way in her party. That's impossible to deny. Where she's thrown onto this list of Time Person of the Year. I don't even know if there actually is a Time magazine. I don't see it in my checkout lane anymore, but as a cultural phenomenon, apparently it still exists. She has evolved in that sense, and she became a national player. And right now, because of her work with Joe Biden and her clearly that he likes her, he considered her strongly for vice president. She's in a position to get a lot more help from the federal government, and that indeed could help her make progress on a lot of fronts and maybe help her make that move to other policy issues that I talked about earlier.
Adrian, if we take COVID as Gretchen Whitmer's defining moment, what gears did you see her? Did you see her opening up this year?
I've been pretty impressed overall with how she's been able to handle what are a lot of competing interests during COVID. You know, I've known the governor for a long time. I worked with her when I was a staffer in the legislature, like John did. And you know, she's really, I think she's really grown into this leadership role in a way that you sort of have to during a crisis. And there are a lot of competing interests to balance here, you know, whether we're talking about things like, you know, public education and high school sports, or we're talking about things, you know, like the contraction of our economy and, you know, balancing the ability of small business owners to operate with the sort of demands of public health. And I think she's overall been a pretty steady hand. That's not to say that there haven't been some, you know, complaints and some legitimate complaints along the way.
Can Adrian tell us what those complaints are? Let's hear that, Adrian.
You know, I think that there's some, I think that's fair. I think that there are some legitimate complaints about some of the messaging getting muddled a little bit at times. And I think that that's fair. And there have been some, you know, look, I'm pretty active in some trade associations, that sort of thing. There's been some, what I think is kind of legitimate complaining of about some of the timing of the announcements. You know, around some of the COVID measures. It's hard to implement something when it gets announced on late afternoon on a Friday. But I think that those are overall relatively minor in the grand scheme of things. And this has been pretty strong leadership.
I wonder, as we go forward, you know, just like we looked at our schools and we may have been frustrated at first that they were wholly unprepared to operate in any kind of distance learning manner, or by, you know, being prepared to actually use technology in a real way to connect with parents. And now they've gotten, most of them have gotten a whole lot better with that. Over time, you know, a crisis breeds innovation. And now we have to start to wonder if that's been the case for the governor with her policies on shutdowns and how she's handling who gets shut down and how. In the past, when she was running shutdowns, her opponents were a bunch of, you know, folks with machine guns running around the Capitol. Pretty easy to hold the upper hand in that situation. That's not what's happening now. Now we're a lot further into it, and she's still making decisions in a fairly similar way in how she shuts things down and the limitations of her explanations for why she's doing it, the detailed explanations, the big picture explanations, obvious, because the people that are upset are not gun-toting folks over on the Capitol lawn. They're the people that we go and get, we buy a hamburger from down on Main Street.
That is absolutely true. And there are restaurants that are, you know, actively, even as we have this conversation, that are actively considering defying shutdown orders. But at the same time, Gretchen Whitmer is on the other side of a state lawsuit that challenged her ability to put any restrictions in place. That kind of resistance to executive power does seem to be one of the things that is new in 2020.
Well, I think those folks are fighting for their very survival. I don't think they see it in terms of I'm just out here to resist executive authority. That was a way easier thing to frame in that fashion when you were up against some militia guys out front that were carrying around signs and nooses and all that stuff. That's not what's happening right now. She's up against Main Street and how she handled them. No one is blaming Gretchen Whitmer, the governor, for COVID. No one's blaming Gretchen Whitmer for how long it's taking to get a hold of it or how long the vaccines will take to get out. But they are going to start to say, okay, back in February and March, we were all caught off guard by this and you made a lot of decisions. Now we're like all the way to the end of the year and you're kind of doing things the same way. And it's having a pretty hurtful effect. And I think that's why she suddenly jumped out and said, well, I've been banging the drum to get Congress to do something about an aid package. And then they were probably sitting around the table like I did when I worked for elected officials. Say, what else can we do? And they're like, okay, well, let's call in the Michigan legislature to put out an aid package. When it's, you know, it's her decision making that's putting those businesses, those jobs, those livelihoods and lifetime savings all on the line. And they're saying, hey, wait a minute, we've been following the rules. We're trying to do it the right way. Why are you picking on us? And I think that's a reasonable thing to question.
The governor and the legislature are operating in an environment in which public health officials and hospitals are saying one thing and businesses are saying another. And I wonder how that's affecting our ideas about what public officials' responsibility is right now. Adrian, what do you make of the seeming disconnect, and the framing of the issue that it has to be business or public health?
Number one, I am absolutely certain of the fact that I'm glad I don't have Gretchen Whitmer's job right now. This is part of what I meant by needing to balance competing interests, and they're important competing interests, you know, protecting small business owners, particularly in the economic conditions of the pandemic, where the largest firms in our economy continue to reap huge gains, is a really important interest that you have to balance against both public health more broadly and the needs of our healthcare system to be able to respond to sick people when they need care. And it's there's not a right answer to that. And so, like I said, I'm very glad that I don't have her job right now. But, you know, you sort of laid that issue out pretty starkly there. And it's not I don't think it's possible to find a right answer or an answer that's going to satisfy everyone.
This is our annual wrap up of Politics News. We're talking with Adrian Hemond of Grassroots Midwest and John Selleck of Harbor Strategic. Some conservatives labeled Governor Whitmer a tyrant over the public health restrictions. And at the same time, we saw this year the FBI arresting several dozen men accused of plotting to kidnap and possibly harm the governor. So here we are out on the political ledge. We heard John talk a little bit about, you know, returning from that edge and tamping down extremism. Adrian, I wonder if you have any thoughts on what brings us back in this moment.
You know, I think the most important thing is that people have got to learn how to have their conversations about politics first and foremost outside of public before they start screaming at each other in public, right? We're, as a society, we're very bad at talking to people that we disagree with, and that is imported into our politics now. And in order for that situation to improve that you're referring to, we've got to get better at having these real sort of conversations outside the public eye before we're ready to do it in public, or we're going to continue to get the same sort of toxicity that we're getting right now.
John, as we think about next year and pivoting into what what other marvelous things 2021 might bring to us, let's assume for the moment that we get a modicum of improvement in COVID cases. Vaccinations start to become a little bit more widely available. What do you see as some of the priorities for state leaders next year?
Sure. Well, I think that the governor's made clear that she personally feels, and I think the polling and issues still show, that fixing the roads is something that she promised that she would make some progress on and get it done. And she's going to need to get that done. You know, I mentioned earlier, I worked for a governor, John Engler. He also faced a road problem. Roads are not a new problem. You know, in the third year of one of his terms when I worked for him, he also had to do a gas tax increase, and he suited up in an MDOT jacket, and we made a big schedule, and he went all over the state trying to show that projects were getting done. So I expect to see that from Governor Whitmer, because even though we haven't talked about this $3.5 billion road plan she announced at the beginning of the year, it's been being put in place this whole time behind the scenes while she's doing these other things. So we should be expecting seeing a flurry of activity on that front. And then as far as like what Adrian mentioned earlier is the other big thing coming, is what will the districts of the state senators and congressmen and state house members look like? That new citizen committee that is still struggling to get all its staff put together and get rolling is supposed to have all its maps out and in place, I think, by November 1st, if I'm not mistaken, Adrian. That's going to have a really big impact on the anxiety level of legislators and making decisions between now and then. And then once they find out what their maps, it's sort of like when we went back to school in the fall and found out who our teachers were going to be. There's a lot of anxiety beforehand, and we're heading for that right now.
Yeah. Adrian, I remember somewhere back in the decade that was 2020, I remember us talking a bit about how this year might be different for some things in our society, how healthcare might be different, how education might be different. Do you sense any stomach for that once maybe the basic emergency of the pandemic subsides a bit?
I mean, I think it really depends, right? Americans and Michiganders, people have been through a lot. And I think the number one thing that people want right now is they just want to be able to take a breath. They want to feel like, you know, they can live a little short stretch of their lives without having to worry about top politics or about this novel disease spreading around. You know, I mean, we've had a lot of other stuff go on in Michigan too, you know, the flooding in Midland this year. People are worn out. And so I think it remains to be seen how much appetite there is to really press forward with big political and policy change. I think people want to rest.
Yeah, I'm sure that that's probably true. I wonder if there's anything else that's on either of your minds, just about everything that's changed and everything that hasn't in 2021, John.
I think Adrian hits on a really important point. We're going to see the two like energy bases of the parties, the progressives and the Trumps, really still battling it out. And that's just going to happen in front of our eyes through cable news or wherever on social media. On the Republican side, we're going to see President Trump, you know, not being president, seeing if he can hold on to the party in his own image and in his own control from Twitter. And you're going to see a whole bunch of other people thinking, I've got to see if I can get in on this and speak the language of Trumpism, especially for a lot of Republicans that are already elected right now, who could be facing primaries by people who see themselves as more, you know, pure heirs to the Trumpian future. And then on the Democratic side, obviously Joe Biden, who I do think will have a lot of strength to resist a lot of progressive things. He's already taken on a ton of attacks from the progressive wing of his own party and who he's putting in positions and what policies are going to move forward. And in that sense, from a political aspect, the best thing for, I think, for Republicans, at least on the ground here, is that they get back to what the traditional steps are, that the beginning of the year is kicked off with a State of the Union type address. It's not officially the State of the Union in the president's first year. And a state of the state address, and that the Democrats lay out what their policy agenda is for 2021. And the Republicans then get to start responding to that and positioning themselves up against it. But I would say, you know, the great middle, to the extent it exists, people who are not so active in politics, I agree with Adrian. They are exhausted and they're tired, and the stats show it. And that's the scarier part. The stats about increases in drug overdoses, in reports of mental health distress and depression, alcohol abuse, domestic violence. You go down the road, we're seeing a huge amount of that. And America could really use a breather. That's for sure. I agree with Adrian on that front. I know I could.
Not to mention the still climbing COVID cases that we're dealing with in Michigan and across the country. Adrian, anything else on your mind?
You know, I'm very interested to see what's going to happen post January 20th with Donald Trump and his role in the Republican Party. I think a really interesting question is what role are the social media companies going to play there? You know, by the time the Donald Trump phenomenon had really spun out of control as far as Twitter was concerned, he was the president. And so there really wasn't much that you could do about that. Once he's no longer the president, I strongly suspect he's going to get kicked off of Twitter. And if and when that happens, that's got some interesting implications for his ability to continue to control the Republican Party. If he doesn't have that social media platform, you know, most of the activist base of the Republican Party is not on Parler. I'm not sure how he reaches them, particularly if there are other things to cover and a lot of cable news has moved on.
Well, does it matter if he's off Twitter, if the people who follow him on other channels are still tuned in to say the Breitbarts of the world, or on Parler or on Reddit?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's certainly an element of that, right? But the fewer outlets that he's got to reach out into the public and spread misinformation and this sort of, for lack of a better term, sort of Dolchstoss legend that he's trying to pass off, that he was robbed of the election, the fewer outlets that he's got to do that, the harder and harder it gets for him, you know, for his brand to dominate the Republican Party, right? You've got to have ways to organize and get those people to show up in a way that's meaningful for you. If he wants to say, you know, position himself as a candidate for president 4 years from now, he's got to be able to keep that stream of communication up with the base. And, you know, a lot fewer people are on things like Reddit and Parler than are on Facebook and Twitter.
You guys are absolutely killing me. We're looking forward to 2021 and we're still talking about Donald Trump and Twitter. Oh, my gosh. All right. New Year's resolution. We're going to have at least one Trump-free conversation before April of next year. Fair enough?
Deal.
Okay. We've been talking with Adrian Hemond of Grassroots Midwest and John Selleck of Harbor Strategic. Guys, thank you so much for helping us out with this year-end wrap-up. It's great to hear your voices.
Thank you, April.
Always a pleasure.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Bear. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time.